Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Bunganyi. Now, reports show that each year, Africans in the diaspora send billions of dollars back to their home countries. They send money to their extended families, their friends and churches, etc. And the recipients of this money use these resources to provide for their daily needs, like buy food or pay school fees for their children, or use it to support causes or initiatives that benefit them or their communities. Sending money is the colloquial term used by most African immigrants in the West and young professionals who live in urban areas. It is an expectation and unspoken rule that when you make it, you have the responsibility to provide a hand up for those you left behind. In some African countries, like South Africa, they refer to it as a black tax. Low levels of upward mobility are particularly common among black communities that also suffer from generational poverty. But the question we want to look at today on the show is not how much Africans remit to the continent or how much we give our relatives and friends, but whether this form of sharing prosperity amounts to some form of philanthropy as we have come to understand it in Western towns. Let's start off by listening to your opinions. Do you send money back home?
Actually, it's once or twice a month, me receiving money, or sending both ways, I should say. Yes, so if I make it in life, I would still love if I would send my relatives back home some money. At least they could make plans and budget for themselves rather than me buying them something and sending to them. They will still expect to get money from me.
I send money to my relatives and friends whenever they need it. I don't know how many times in a month or a year. The last time I received money from my relatives is when I was at school. I used to receive money in terms of fees and pocket money.
I usually send money to my family and relatives once a month, and I don't really necessarily expect them to give back any money to me, so I hardly receive money from my relatives. And I just feel that once you've made it in life, once you've made it successfully, it's always a good gesture to always appreciate each and every single person that just stood by you, especially family.
Thanks for providing your opinions on our topic today, and we want to welcome you if you're just joining us. On our show today, we are looking at the issue of remittances, the money that we send home to our extended families and friends to help buy food or pay for health costs, school fees, etc. In South Africa, they have a special term for these kinds of transactions. They call it a black tax. In a country where the majority of the black population grapples with generational poverty, many families depend on a relative who has made it, often living in a city, or has had access to better education or employment. They depend on them to supplement or act as a primary source of income. Nadia Sami is in Johannesburg, South Africa. Nadia, welcome. Now, Nadia, in some countries, black tax is an axiom that states black people must work harder than their counterparts to achieve similar outcomes. But in South Africa, it's different. How do you explain it in South Africa?
The reality is black tax is something many young African students and professionals are saddled with across the continent or wherever they may find themselves in the world. Picture this scenario. Tandi is young. She's just graduated from university, the first person in her family to do so, and she lands a great job. So life should be good and the money should be flowing, right? Wrong, because Tandi must still repay her student loan and she's now expected to start supporting her family. That entry-level salary of hers will now be stretched, so some of it reaches her parents and extended family members, and she'll also be told to contribute to the school fees of her younger siblings. On top of that, she needs to, of course, pay her own living expenses, food, transport costs, etc. It's a scenario playing out for millions of young people who don't have family wealth or inheritance to fall back on. Slindile Xaba is a media professional in Johannesburg. She explains what black tax means to her.
I think mostly because, you know, it's in the quest of trying to reverse the cycle of poverty. So you are in a family of people that have never seen tertiary schooling before. So when you succeed, they feel like they all have, and you also feel like, you know what, it wasn't just me, it was the extended family that assisted me. So you feel like giving back in that way. So because, you know, where we grow up, it's like a collective effort. So when you, or rather when your money grows up, you must pay back the money or give back, you know. So that's what Black Tax is all about.
This money, what has become known colloquially in South Africa as Black Tax, is necessary for the survival of families. Sometimes it comes in the form of a message from a relative saying they need money for bread, milk, or airtime. Or a family may have to take in an extended family member because there's no one else to care for that person. It puts a lot of pressure on young people who are starting out in life who may otherwise have used this money towards a car or a first apartment or some travel. Now, this is not a burden that all youth carry equally. For example, many young Black South Africans would say that their white friends can't relate to this need, this necessity to always send money home. It's a concept that's quite foreign to people who grew up privileged, but it's such a reality and such a part of life for people who have emerged from the struggle, who have emerged from an apartheid era that really, really disenfranchised the Black masses. And so this inequality, when you look 20 years into democracy in South Africa, 20 years odd into democracy in South Africa, that inequality still sits there, you know. It means that the Black student always has to put in so much more to just appear to be socially on par with a white counterpart, for example.
Every month I basically have to cater for my family who live in another province. I would basically send money down for my mother just to support her, and I would also send to my nephews as well. Reason being is that both parents aren't working, and even if they work, they don't always earn enough money. So I'm sending money to help them. Yes, I basically have to budget for it on a monthly basis.
Well, a huge, not huge, large part of my salary goes to Black Tax. Like, my mom expects, well, not really expects, but, you know, I give her because it makes me feel good. And then my sister just had a baby, so I find myself just, like, wanting to spend money on her. I just put her on my medical aid, Black Tax.
Black Tax, Jackson, call it what you will. It's a reality for so many people, for so many of our listeners, for you and me. One hopes that it's something this generation manages to address, that some equilibrium will come, that the inequalities of the past don't haunt us forever, and that, you know, it's not something we end up handing over to our children and them to their children.
Thank you very much, Nadia Sami. That was Nadia Sami. She is in Johannesburg, South Africa. In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Bunganyi. Now, of late, there has been growing debate on whether Africans who have attained a certain level of economic success should be giving back or giving more to their communities. The argument for this is that most of the philanthropic initiatives to the continent are driven by Western entities like, you know, the Bill Gates Foundation and others. But the counter argument to that is that Africans already practice their own forms of philanthropy. Like we had from Nadia in South Africa, young people in urban centers send money home to their extended families to pay for food, for health costs, for school fees, and many other costs. Is this, in essence, a form of African philanthropy? To help us better understand this, I reached out to my friend Omolola Adele Oso. She's a Nigerian-American activist based in Washington, D.C. Omolola heads an initiative known as Diaspora Rise Up, which has been involved in campaigns to raise funds from the African diaspora, funds to help with causes like the Ebola crisis, the mudslides in Sierra Leone, and many others. Omolola, let me start off by asking you about Diaspora Rise Up. How did you start it? When did you start it? What was your inspiration behind it?
So Diaspora Rise Up is a campaign and a fund that our organization, Act for Accountability, launched last year. And the premise, the reason we launched it last year is because, one, as a diaspora organization that has been, you know, looking for funding to support some of the community engagement work that we were doing, but also partnering with local African organizations that we have seen, whether it was trying to find a credible organization working during the Sierra Leonean flooding or the flooding in Nigeria, in Benue, or trying to identify one even in Congo. It was just so frustrating to find any credible organization that I could immediately say to members of my community that were asking, here is who you can give money to, and here's how you can give money to them to support the recovery efforts that they were doing.
Okay.
And so it kind of started off from there, that over the years of paying it and seeing that, you know, in the NGO world, a lot of the organizations that are doing work in Africa on development issues are not Black, are not local, created, run organizations. Yes, they may have staff that are local in the administrative role, but the key decision makers are oftentimes not people from the communities who can have a stronger influence on the kind of interventions that are used in their communities to support the people of their community.
Right, understanding the local reality
of the issues. Exactly, you know, understanding the norms. You know, we've all heard the stories of the, you know, I don't want to name any particular one, but they come, they have their little programs that they set up, and then you follow up in a year or so, and that program really is dead. But Diaspora Rise Up was an opportunity to say, what if we did create a fund? What if we did create a campaign to encourage those of us who are part of the diaspora to rise up, to play a more visible role in the development and in the support of organizations that are pushing to do great work in their community so that nobody's left behind?
Now, there has been a criticism, and this is a conversation I've had with so many other people, including those who are wealthy enough to be able to give back in more visible ways. The criticism is that Africans in general do not give to African causes, and that we have not seen efforts like this, like Diaspora Rise Up, where people that have are giving back to the have-nots, who can do more.
I think that they have. Well, so they have been. So that's where, you know, some of the challenge also came, because even I, you know, had thought that, you know, maybe there is a problem that why aren't we giving more? Like, what's wrong with us? Like, we have money. We have people with high net worth and high net worth and access to wealth that we see all the time. So what are they doing with their money? And when I started to peel back the onion, I realized that was actually a false assumption,
right,
that Black people are not giving and wealthy people are not giving. They are giving. However, it shows up in different forms.
Right. And so we already give, it's just that it's not understood in the way Western terms of
and
giving.
Data has not been collected.
Right.
So that's actually the key, is data. There are a lot of data on how white people and wealth and, you know, philanthropy, traditional philanthropy in that sense. However, when it comes to communities of color and the way communities of color give, it looks different than, you know, we're not necessarily the people who see the Save the Children ad, you know, on TV that says give $5 a month with the fly, you know, on the child and give $5 a month to help Muhammad, you know, live. We're not mm-hmm. necessarily the people who will be reaching into our wallets to say that, you know, the organization I'm going to give to. Because in many different cases, it may not look like that particular child on it. But we all have families. We all come from communities where people are doing their own part, whether it is supporting family in going to college or with bills, like basic necessities.
Right.
Because the unemployment situations are real and very stark.
Mostly black communities or in Africa in general, on the African continent. Right.
Exactly. And here in America, you know, you have people, black people, the number one place black people give is to their religious institutions.
Right.
So you can't tell me that black people aren't giving. It's just a matter of where are the data that is showing that.
Is it also possible that we understand philanthropy in different terms? Philanthropic institutions or traditional philanthropy is understood by some communities, non-African communities, is different from how we do understand it as Africans.
Yeah, we don't call it philanthropy. We don't call it philanthropy. I'm just helping my family. I'm helping my community. You know, when you start linguistically, start paying attention to how people talk about supporting each other. They're like, yes, you know, I just sent some money home. You know, that's a common phrase.
Right.
I just sent some money home. And whether it is through Western Union or in an envelope.
Which is something that we've been doing for so many years. For us who have been living out here for many years, we understand how much, we know how much we have to send home to whether our cousins or our families. Of recent, many African governments have been capturing data on remittances and the impact remittances have had on development in Africa. I think The dollar rate is around 30 billion, which is a huge sum of money.
It's actually up to 60 billion.
That third concept of giving to our churches or religious churches, has there been, an effort to capture that type of data to understand how much it is?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a few challenges there. Mm. You know, one, because churches are not often the most transparent with their how much they actually take in. So that's a challenge. But also, when it comes to data and research in general, you have to have somebody funded to do that kind of collection. And that's, I think, an opportunity where traditional philanthropy for now can support the funding of this, because it's a missed opportunity. You know, and on top of that, you know, there are other, so what there's also this middle group, this kinship donors that I'm talking about.
Yes, kinship donors, right.
A lot of the big portion of how we give as black people actually funnels through kinship donors. So you think about sororities and fraternities. You think about community associations, you know, whether it is, you know, I'm a Yoruba person, I'm from Nigeria. It could be like the Nigerian diaspora organization, NIDO, or something like that. They may have like a giving aspect where it's a membership due, they pay, but in part of their membership due, the benefits include doing some charitable work. And so you have a lot of money, which I probably think is in the billions, that go through these kinds of association kinship funnel channels. But that data is not being collectively analyzed as to how much it actually is. And I think it's probably in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And on top of that, these organizations, a lot of them don't often also
disperse the money back.
Exactly. Or they don't even leverage the tax-deductible benefits that America offers.
Mm.
And so when they give, they just give. But imagine if you were getting a tax-deductible receipt on your charitable giving. Guess what? Next year, you probably give some more.
Absolutely. And which brings me to this next question is, Is this type of informal giving holding us back as a community or individually as people? Because I know personally I give a lot of money to relatives and institutions that are helping causes that are dear to me, like schools and not necessarily churches. But do you feel that if we had a way to, I guess, capture the data, to formalize this way, that it would advance us as a people? Also, most importantly, it would encourage more people to give.
Yes, and that's part of, you know, what I'm going to be talking about, is that how do we, there are multiple things that kind of stand in the way of us realizing that we actually give, but it needs some coordination. And so, you know, one of it is the issue of trust. You know, quite often we still are a little hesitant to give to organizations because we trust that they will use the money the way they say they want to use the money. That's one part. But the other part, which is what you're speaking to, is there has to be coordination and bringing together entities, because most of these entities are not connected to each other. So whether it's the affiliated Greek organizations, you know, working together, what if they all put their money together in a larger pot? Imagine what that could do. If these, you know, associations by maybe country or geographic location actually put all their money together, imagine what kind of impact they could have. So there is a lot of coalition building that could happen, and I think is probably what we need to, the road we need to start moving down with, down. But, you know, again, like with everything else, we're not a monolithic people either. How do you bring very sometimes diverse interests together to say, you know what, let us all put pots of money together that could scale the kind of impact we have, but also could actually draw more money? Because guess what? Even these other traditional philanthropy entities, they are missing an opportunity of actually leveraging
right.
Black giving. Mm-hmm. For example, one idea could be community foundations. And in America, a lot every region has a community foundation. And so let's say you take a group of community associations that are from Nigeria, for example, who put together their money into a donor advised fund that is managed by a community foundation. That's an entity that has a structure that can help them with the grant making process, this, and then at the end of the day, this entity, this coalition, gets a report on where your money went, how it was spent, the reporting channel, so you don't have to worry about all this stuff, but you also get the ability to say, at the end of the year, you can say that you gave this amount out, and you can reap the tax deductible benefit.
But what about giving to families when you know, we give again to families? You have family in Nigeria. I'm quite sure you send money back home. That is income that you cannot write off on your taxes.
Correct. There will always, I think there will always be that kind of family giving that is not connected to some kind of charitable thing. And unfortunately, it also has a double-edged sword, because those of us who are in the diaspora feel two pains. We have to live and we have our own responsibility here. And we also have an unspoken sometimes, you know, responsibility for family at home. And that puts a lot of strain on our financial needs and our financial capabilities. So when, you know, you may approach a person, diasporizer, we may approach you and say, you know, give $20 a day. Sometimes $20 a day is a lot when you are supporting not just one family here, but multiple families wherever you can, because you are really seen as the only lifeline for a lot of people. So it makes it tough when in that kind of situation. And I think that, you know, that kind of giving is not going to go away. It isn't.
Is there a way, though, to formalize it? Would there be a way, I guess, to whether it's as a community effort? I know in Kenya, for example, they have things they call Harambe, where if a relative is sick or has some sort of big financial need, that, you know, community gets together and they fundraise for that person.
Yeah, you have that.
Right.
You know, you have the Esusu, you know, the monthly giving circles, you know, that people are part of and communities are part of. So you are going to see that those are actually on the rise because communities are seeing that they are beneficial. But again, it comes down to when you have, if we take a community that there are a lot of people that are struggling in that same community, it becomes more of a challenge to say who should get this pot of money this month versus this other family.
Right. So people, who is more deserving than the other?
Exactly. Who is more deserving? So in addition to those, people still extend to families they see as those who can provide, which is where the Black tax comes in, where those who have been able to attain some sort of, you know, affluence or, and when I say the term affluence, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be making $100,000 a year. You could just be making $40,000 a year, but it's more than what people.
For $40,000 is a lot of money to some people. So,
that's a lot of money compared to what some other people are making.
Right.
And so they see you as a possible hope and a lifeline. So in addition to those monthly circles, you will still have that, you know, connection to say, hey cousin, hey this, I need a, you know, I want to go to grad school or I want to start a small business. Like I want to buy a sewing machine so I can, I'm skilled, I'm talented in this area, I can start my own business from home. I mean, regardless of where I am, I always try to do that, is that if I'm the first person or I'm the second person, who's the next person coming behind me? So that there's one thing that I strongly believe is part of how it helps us.
This concept
of Black tax helps us. Now, the other part that, you know, I think is a little bit of the challenge where some people feel resentment towards their families. Like, I worked my behind off, you know, I got myself here. Why can't you do the same for yourself? Well, there are many environmental factors. There are many social factors that we don't know about that make it challenging for one person versus another to be able to say, you're a success story and I'm not.
Right.
That being said, it can have a financial strain on the person who's so quote unquote made it out. But on the other hand, we still see that more and more programs are actually starting to focus on how do we support those who haven't made it out yet? How, you know, you're seeing local community organizations like setting up shopping and targeting, whether it's young Black men or Black women or Black families, or tackling issues like, you know, mass incarceration that are affecting how and why people are stuck in the situations and environments they find themselves in. So in that sense, yes, how can Black tax help? Maybe what we do is instead of giving to the individuals, we give to the organizations that have set up shop in the communities that are doing amazing work to reverse that trend.
And it could also be a family organization, a family,
exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you could set up your own family organization. Again, going back to the often underutilized community foundations where you can set up your own family donor advised fund. And all you do is put money in it and you tell them where you want the money to go and they take care of that for you. Well, and so that's another avenue in how, you know, Black giving or this Black tax concept can, instead of looking at it as a drain and as a strain, we have to look at where the opportunities in existing systems are and how do we now pull together larger parts so that we have a larger impact and that we're not having a conversation 5 years from now saying Black people don't give, because we clearly know that's not true.
That's not true. Thank you very much, Omolola. Thank you all of you for listening into our show today. We would also like to thank all our listeners who contributed to the show this time around. And if you have any questions or comments or want to contribute to the show in future, remember to send us an email at upfront@voanews.com. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, my handle is @upfrontafrica. Let's connect again next week, right here, same time. On behalf of my colleague Nadia Sami, my name is Jackson Vunganyi. Goodbye. Hey, yo, no pretty boy in a no Chris Nike boot. She don't fall for no dapper. She don't cry for no dupe. She said those lonely. This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall.